right here.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We got to talk about vaccines because West Coast governors in America, the West Coast governors, Oregon, Washington, and California, have said they are going to form a coalition and establish their own vaccine and immunization recommendations. And your first reaction to that might be, doesn't the FDA do that? Doesn't the CDC do that? Well, the governors of Oregon, Washington, and California got together and said they are going to form a cabal to establish their own vaccine and immunization recommendations because they don't like the changes that are happening at the CDC. In some ways, this is more than comical. About two-thirds of Americans decided to be vaccinated. About one-third did not. I'm one of those. I chose not to take the mRNA jab. And an awful lot of people lost their jobs because they were told either get jabbed or lose your job. That applied to private institutions. It applied to the military under Joe Biden. And an awful lot of military members were forced out. And there were an awful lot of healthcare professionals. Imagine that. People who are in the healthcare industry and have the healthcare background who said, I am not taking that jab. And they got fired for it. Well, now the Democrat governors of the West Coast have said they're not happy. So they're going to make their own recommendations. Now, I don't know what they're going to do this on, but in some ways, as a citizen, I look at this and I think this is even more than comical because here's what's happening. We are taking the immunization recommendations, which are apparently not to the liking of the governors of Oregon, Washington, California. They're going to make their own. So one agency we don't trust, the CDC, is not making their recommendations. So other agencies we also don't trust at the government level, governors and their state health departments and all that, they will be doing it instead. Do you know what this is really all about? It's about money. And I'll tell you why in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Get a lot of naysayers that way as well. And you can vote in our X poll. Today's X poll. And you're going to find this question a familiar one, although I can't, there's no way to actually check this. I think for the first time in American history, it's the first time that a president has actually said we should arm some of the classroom teachers to safeguard schools against the kind of violent incidents that sadly happen too often at schools, both public and private schools. President Donald Trump, during a press conference on Tuesday afternoon, said that a small percentage of teachers should be armed for classroom defense. In fact, here's the quote. We have great teachers that love our children. The parents love the children. The teachers love the children, too. And if you took a small percentage of those teachers, the ones that had been in the military, that were distinguished in the military, that were in the National Guard, and you let them carry, they trained and they know about weapons, I've always thought that would be an alternative. So the question today on X, should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers against violent attacks? My answer to that would be yes. You can answer the question any way you like. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show and on my website at LarsLarson.com. And let me in advance anticipate some of your objections, because I've heard these objections on this program for almost 30 years. People saying, well, what if a teacher doesn't want to be armed? You don't need to arm the teachers that are anti-gun. All you need to do is afford teachers the opportunity. Every time we've talked about this, I end up hearing from teachers, both by email and on social media and on the program, by phone calls, who say, if they allow me to carry, I want to carry. If they require me to take some extra training or use frangible bullets, if they require me to make certain conditions under which I carry. There are teachers out there ready to volunteer to do exactly what President Trump is suggesting. Now, if anybody can think of another American president who has suggested arming teachers, I'm reasonably sure Reagan didn't. I know Bill Clinton did not. Barack Obama, forget about it. Joe Biden didn't know what day it was. So really, we have the first American president to make the suggestion, let's arm some of the teachers. It has worked, and there are states in which teachers already routinely carry a gun. The kids don't have to know about it. Their boss would, either the superintendent or the principal of the school. But it's a great idea, and it would have stopped so much violence in so many schools. And in fact, in some private schools, violent actions have been stopped by either security guards or by teachers who are carrying a gun. So I think it's a great idea. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show. But let me get back to these vaccine guidelines. So here's the reason those governors of the West Coast states are saying we're angry that Donald Trump is dismantling the CDC. I'm not. I think there are an awful lot of people in that agency that we found out over the last 5 years, going back to the beginning of the pandemic, who led the public astray, who openly lied to the public about all kinds of things, whether it was 6 foot separation, whether it was masks, whether it was the vaccine. Remember when Joe Biden in 2021, just 4 years ago, said, if you get the vaccine, you can't catch COVID. And then lots and lots of people who'd been vaccinated and boosted over and over again, they caught COVID. So do I trust the CDC? Nope. Do I trust the state health departments or the politicians, the governors? No. I think this is all about money, because really they hide it in coded language that unfortunately a lot of people in the cartel media don't bother to decode for their, I'm going to decode it for you though. They say, we want to ensure that our residents remain protected by science, not politics. Well, there was a whole lot of politics going on during the pandemic, and an awful lot of the decisions they made and the recommendations that they fronted had to do with politics. But they said, we want to make sure that people have access. Do you know what access means in this case? They want the health insurance companies to pay for the vaccine. Now, if you go out and buy the jab, if you're so inclined to get the mRNA jab, costs about $200 if you want to do it with your own money. If it's covered by insurance, as everybody says, it's free. Only everybody knows it's not really free. It's either paid for by your tax dollars or it's paid for by your insurance premiums. And I know the pharmaceutical companies, they want to be able to keep on selling millions and millions and millions of doses of this stuff. They want people to do it every single year. And they want you to pay for it through your premiums, or in the case of Medicaid and Medicare, they want you to pay for it through your taxes. But that's the real issue here. If somebody goes to a doctor and says, Doc, I really think I'm at risk. I'd like to get the jab for whatever reason. I don't have to agree with them, but they have a right to do that. If the doctor writes them a script, they can go right down to Walgreens or CVS and they can get the jab. But they're going to be paying a couple hundred dollars. And of course, the vaccine companies know that if it's free, covered by insurance, because free really isn't free, that the vaccine manufacturers are going to make and sell millions and millions of doses of this stuff. And if it's not covered by insurance, they're going to sell a whole lot less. And they'll have less money to bribe the people at CDC and FDA and probably the state health departments as well. Glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, and the Northwest Nonsense is coming up next. Hey,
new plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
that great moment every day, where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, now, guess what? We're going to have to wait more weeks to find out if your so-called representatives in Salem, who do not listen to citizens at all, will pass the biggest tax hike in Oregon history. One Democrat is sick and can't make it, so the Senate vote on the package is being delayed. Democrats need every single vote that they've got to jam this nightmare tax increase through. Over the weekend, one Republican gave up his vote despite testimony from 4,000 citizens against that tax hike. 10 minutes on the radio yesterday with Tillamook lawmaker Cyrus Javidi only leaves you more confused about why in the world he voted for it. Javidi, among other things on the interview yesterday, said, "We gave ODOT plenty of money." His words, "We still have the same traffic problems despite giving them all the money. I don't trust ODOT. I hate taxes." All the statements of Mr. Javidi yesterday. But Javidi voted yes anyway with the Democrats. He admits that ODOT has deceived citizens by lowballing its huge projects that then rack up literally hundreds of millions of dollars in cost overruns. No one at ODOT ever gets fired. He admits the Rose Quarter I-5 widening is a functionally dead project. Interstate bridge replacement, much the same. ODOT committed hundreds of millions to one of those, $1 billion to the bridge. So why not shift that money that was committed to dead projects to immediate critical needs like highway maintenance and winter snow plowing? I asked Javidi why he would instead give more money to people he says he doesn't trust at ODOT who've lied to the citizens. Javidi says that's a good question, but an answer, he does not have one. 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go first. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Can citizens immediately gather signatures to refer the Oregon legislature's crazy new tax package, which I expect them to pass in a couple of weeks, for ODOT? Can they put it on the ballot? The short answer is no. So I got a note from Jason Williams from the Taxpayers Association. Lars, about the referendum I mentioned, the 90-day clock for gathering signatures starts at the final signing by both chambers. Technically, it is the day of sine die, which in the past has been about the same time as most of the referendum bills get signed at the end of the session. The governor can eat into that clock by delaying the signing, which is required for a referendum to be approved. So the 90-day clock starts even though you're not allowed to start gathering signatures. Crazy, isn't it? Jason, I absolutely agree. My favorite post of the day on X today, as you know, for almost 30 years, the theme song of this show, you only hear a bit of it at the beginning, is AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Well, a team of biologists conducting research along the California-Oregon border is now experimenting with some unconventional methods to deter wolves from going out and eating or killing cattle. By using AC/DC's Thunderstruck, along with movie clips and even live human voices, they aim to keep the wolves at bay. They fly drones over the wolves and then play AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Maybe that sets the wolves on edge. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the mayor of Seattle. That's Bruce Harrell. He's been invited on this show any number of times. He's never agreed to come on and answer questions. But now he's saying to Seattle, don't back away from Sound Transit, which is the ridiculous and contradictory name for their light rail program up in Seattle in the Puget Sound area. He says he wants them to prioritize projects that connect high-density neighborhoods. Even though the cost of light rail has now increased more than 25%, if you want to connect high-density neighborhoods, you can buy buses right now and they can be on the road immediately, or you can pay billions of dollars for light rail and it'll be on the rails about a decade from now. Which one do you think is the more sensible choice, and which one is the one that Bruce Harrell chose? Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. This comes from Colleen, and it's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes because I had them do it for me. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. So Colleen says, Lars, will massive taxes make Oregon Democrats wake up? I don't think so. I think they will either believe whatever the local media spinners blame the high prices on, or they're going to move and vote for the same things in those cities. Although I agree, Democrat-elected lawmakers should pay the consequences. I think Oregon Democrat voters are blinded by ideology. I hear some of them on your show. When voters sit down to vote, they will not vote any differently. Although they don't have the choice in many places, I don't see Republicans running for office in Democrat strongholds. ODOT has been doing some weird things with our money. They're putting stupid little roundabouts all over the place in odd places. I think the purpose is to slow down traffic to 25% of the speed limit. And there's no such thing as a temporary government tax. That's what they're claiming some of the tax increases will be. In the 1980s, Mayor Frederico Pena instituted a head tax in Denver, Colorado. It destroyed Denver. Half of Denver was boarded up. Big companies moved to Englewood. But guess what? The head tax is still in effect today. Signed, Colleen. Colleen, thanks very much. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Network and Northwest Network, and your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Let's go to Richard. Hey, Richard, thanks for listening on the network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was just listening to your bit about the vaccine, and I just wanted to throw my two cents in.
Sure.
Year before the vaccine, I had physical perfect numbers, nothing hereditary in my family, and I was forced to get the vaccine. 4 weeks later, developed a blood clot in the right side of my head, which caused the stroke, which led to heart surgery. I was in the hospital for 4 days because they couldn't figure out where it came from. And every time I would mention vaccine, they would not comment at all. So I just thought I'd throw that in for people that say that, you know, you should take it if it's forced on you.
This is why, Richard, I've always thought it should be a choice. And I know there are going to be some people who say they want to have the vaccine. Go ahead. Have the vaccine.
Yep.
Pay for it with your own money, and you can go ahead and do it. And I know that what the real concern here is, I think that Tina Kotek and Bob Ferguson and Gavin Newsom all got the memo. The pharma companies give a lot of money to the Democrats. And you know that if something is covered by insurance, it will be very, very popular, because people perceive it as free because there's no money out of their pocket. If it's not covered by insurance, you won't have nearly as much of it. And the vaccine companies know that too. If it's covered by insurance because the CDC recommends it, then the vaccine companies say, hey, we're going to sell shots at $200 a pop. Somebody will pay the tab and we'll make billions of dollars, which they made already during the pandemic. If it's not covered by insurance, but is merely a choice that people can make, and it might cost them a couple of $100, if you think it's that important to have the shot, go ahead and get it and pay for it. If you don't think it's important, but you only think it's important because the government tells you it's important, I think you're making your healthcare decisions based on the wrong kind of advice. Richard, thanks very much, and I appreciate the call, and I think you're absolutely right. Glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about that wildfire hazard map that was so controversial, and new analysis that shows it was even more flawed than we ever thought it was. Back in a moment.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Did you know Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about this crazy wildfire hazards map that the state of Oregon has now taken two swings at, both, I think, unsuccessful, both very, very expensive, and both done for reasons that I have never been able to wrap my head around, because I know there are people who think, well, the insurance companies use that. No, I've been in touch with the insurance companies. They say, no, we have our own expertise that we apply to figure out whether a property in the woods is at high risk or low risk and how to set the rates and all that. State of Oregon has its own map for some reason, and I thought we'd talk about it with Jeremy Cowie, who is in the statistics business, has analyzed that wildfire hazards map. And he says it is more flawed than anybody ever thought it was before. And Jeremy, if I've overstated that, please feel free to correct me. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah. No, that sounds about right. Also, just be advised, I'm out in the forest in Tillamook. I am elk hunting right now, so I'm using Starlink. So I don't know if it'll drop the call or what.
So at this point, are you a bow hunter or a rifle hunter? You must be a bow hunter, right?
Bo Hunter.
We wish you luck with that. I haven't been able to go in a few years, so I hope you get a big one. But would you mind telling my audience a bit about your background so they know why you have the expertise to do this kind of analysis?
I work in the finance industry. I'm a statistician, and I deal with a lot of different types of models that are built, and one in particular are probability models, which when you dig into the Oregon wildfire map, there is one of those probability components in their modeling process.
So tell my audience, what should they make? There's been a lot of criticism of the wildfire hazards map produced by the state. Was there a good reason for the state to have such a map, and did they produce a map that actually had good information in it?
I can't speak to like the reasoning, because I mean, I don't know, perhaps if they chose a different methodology or something, maybe they could have done a little bit better. That's actually a complex question for that part. But the second part, that you know, that there is a lot to be concerned with. There was two issues that I found. That article that was just posted today just kind of hits on the main issue, which I thought was very very revealing.
And what were they?
Well, the first one was how they estimate the thresholds. They claim that I'm not sure if the audience is familiar with like what a percentile is, but if I order data from smallest to largest, the 90th percentile would mean that roughly 90% of the data lies below that and 10% lies above that. So they claim that they use the 90th percentile of all the final hazard values, and anyone above that is going to be at the highest risk. Anyone below that will be in the other two categories, but the only ones that were hit hardest were the categories in the highest risk. But when I actually look at the final data, and I spoke with their point of contact there at OSU, and I finally got the data and was able to put it in a format that I could do something with, I found that their claimed 90th percentile must be the top 10% highest property hazard values would be in high risk. It actually was the top 58%. So their 90th percentile was actually the 42nd percentile.
So in practical terms, Jeremy, I'm talking to Jeremy Cowie, who's in the statistics business. Does that mean they put a lot more people and their houses into a high-risk category than the data actually justified?
I wouldn't say justified data. That's a whole other avenue. I simply just they made a statement. They also did some funky sampling that made assumptions that didn't actually it didn't actually bear out. And when you look at analyze the data, and they reported that they only used the 90th percentile. So I would say that either they didn't know what they were doing, or they purposely played word games to say that, you know, that they're only doing the top 10%. And if you look at that article, there's a photo in there of the map. There's the 90th percentile that they claim, and then the actual 90th percentile, the final hazard values. I mark them green and red, and you can see the difference. If they went with just the 90th percentile, you could see in that photo that the map high hazard zone shrinks significantly. And I mean, one could speculate that they just did it and didn't find enough risk, so they tried to do some different techniques and sampling so they could maintain that they are using the 90th percentile when they actually are not. So
yeah,
I'm not sure what to take away.
Because if I'm understanding you right, Jeremy, if you say we're only going to take the top 10%, they're at the highest risk, but then you take a number that's more like 58% that you mentioned, you're putting a lot more people in the high-risk category and a lot more houses and property in the high-risk category. Do I understand that right?
Correct. So what they did was you have the full data set, which is several million data points. Then they took a small sample of those data points which are houses that live in the WUI, and they calculated the percentiles from there. And that actually is the 90th percentile of that set. But then they applied it to the full data set, and when you line up the full data set against this smaller subset of the, you know, the WUI subset, the percentile goes from the 90th percentile in the WUI subset to actually more around the 42nd percentile in the full data set. So they didn't mention that second part there. They just mentioned that it's the top 90th percentile, which when on the full data and how they classify everyone's land, it's not.
Okay, so Jeremy, is it statistically valid to take a little sample from a big, you know, 2 million data points and say whatever was in this little sample I took and looked at closely should be able to be applied to the entire set of 2 million points? Is that a valid way to look at the information?
Well, it is. It's not wrong. However, you have to randomly sample. What they did was called bias sampling. They made assumptions and they sampled from that. From those areas to have a to be more accurate, if you sample to represent a population, it'd have to be done randomly.
And if you don't do it randomly, go ahead.
And it would also, there's a lot of other stuff involved in that, like if the data set is multimodal or whatever could happen. But typically, you know, you'd want to be a large sample, and it'd have to be randomly sampled. You couldn't just biasly put your assumptions in there and sample it and say this represents the full data.
Is there any way to tell why they used biased sampling instead of doing it randomly? Because if they're in your business, they know you have to do it randomly or the results aren't valid.
I couldn't speculate as to that. I mean, I did correspond with them, and this is the only question that they would not respond back to me on. They were pretty open and giving me all the data that I need, and I did a back and forth with them quite a bit. And I can't speculate why. I could just say that it's either one of two things. They purposely manipulated it, or they didn't know what they were doing. Neither is a good look.
No, it doesn't sound like it. Jeremy Cowie is a statistician who deals with probability models, talking about that crazy wildfire map that Oregon spent so much money on, and then it turned out, well, the information in it wasn't all that valuable to begin with. Jeremy, thanks very much. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. In a moment, why is Seattle closing three of its major parks for 60 days because of what they call negative activity? We'll dig into that. We'll get to your phone calls and emails, too. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. Seattle is now closing three of its neighborhood parks for 60 days. That'll get us well into the rainy season, I figure. And they're closing them because of what the city of Seattle calls euphemistically negative park activity. Only have to look high and low to find out what is this negative park activity you're talking about. Are kids playing, chess or something? Are they playing loud music? No. Turns out it's mostly homeless camps, and in the case of one of the parks, at least a couple of dead bodies from shootings that happened in that park. That is what they mean by negative activity at the parks. To your calls now. Let's go to Brian first. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. What's on your mind today, Brian?
Hey, I just wanted to comment on the fire map that you had just broadcasted about how flawed it is.
Yep.
And I had an issue. Of course, you know, I had found out about it because I got denied insurance I was changing insurances around and couldn't get my motorcycle insured. And the insurance company told me it was because of the fire map, and I was in a considered a fire zone, and they wouldn't insure my motorcycle. Anyway,
you're out in the woods, and the insurance company.
Yeah, the insurance company. Yeah, even though there's a law against that. Anyway,
a law against what?
Long story short, I checked their fire map out, and I'm in a well-established neighborhood, and across the street from me, they are not in. They're in a green zone, yet I'm in a yellow zone. And if you go north of Redmond, there's new neighborhoods that are in there, and you'll see little spots of green where, like, a residential property is in a green zone, but everybody else around them is in a red. That's how flawed it is.
And I totally agree with you. And, Brian, I guess I find it really I guess it confirms what I think about government an awful lot of the time. But when somebody who's in the statistics business looks at the way they looked at the stats and says, this is what they did with the numbers, and either they, A, don't know what they're doing when it comes to numbers, or B, that they're deliberately gimmicking the data, what does that tell you about the government? And in some ways, it ties into what I started this hour talking about, and that is, Tina Kotek and Bob Ferguson and Gavin Newsom don't like the fact that they don't like the Trump CDC, so they're going to make their own vaccine recommendations. Gee, no opportunity for bias there, is there? Because when the government keeps telling you bad information, only you don't find out it's bad until too late, should you trust them with things as important as whether or not you take a vaccine, whether or not your kids are vaccinated, when you can't trust them with something like a wildfire map and honestly handle the data that goes into that?
Yeah, and I'm wondering if anybody besides the college even took a good look at the data to see where they even gathered it from. You know,
well,
it's like they just populated something. You can go look at Google and see that the neighborhood's shouldn't even be in that zone.
But. Well, and Brian, here's where the fix gets in. And I don't think I'm talking conspiracy theory here, because you say, well, maybe the colleges, because they have, you know, people who are experts in those things. Brian, do you know where the colleges in Oregon and Washington get the majority of their money? They get it through the government, either the state government or the federal government.
Yep.
So do you think they're going to go out and spit in the face of the people who are writing them checks? No, they'll spit in the face of voters and citizens instead. Because I know what happened a couple of decades ago. The guy who was the state climatologist for the state of Oregon, George Taylor, he came on this program and we were talking about global warming 20 years ago. And he said, what the state is doing does not make any sense scientifically. A few weeks later, the state of Oregon, the governor at the time, said, you're fired as the state climatologist. And they gave no specific reason, but George Taylor believed, and I believed as well, that the reason they went after him was because he went out and publicly criticized what the government was doing. So all of the people who have, or most of the people who have the kind of expertise that would allow them to look at that wildfire map and say, this is a bunch of hooey, they're the ones who are drawing checks from institutions that get money from the state government in either Salem or Olympia, and they're not about to cut off their lifeline. So they keep their mouths shut, and they do it out of self-interest. I understand why they're doing it. I understand they don't want to lose their jobs. But what do you do as a citizen when you pay taxes to the federal government and the state government? The state gives the money to the universities. And then when there are people at the universities who can see the flaws in what the state is doing because they're not treating the data in the right way, but they won't say anything about it because if they do, they put themselves at risk of getting cut off. Then as a citizen, you're paying to be spoon-fed bad information. And in this case, creation of wildfire hazard maps that actually put people in a tough spot. It may mean they won't be able to get the kind of protection that they want. It may mean that state bureaucracies will get money that they shouldn't be getting. Oh, and by the way, I want to give you an update. This just came down. The Seattle Fish Wrapper Times is reporting the Washington Supreme Court is going to take up that initiative that a lot of us voted for, the one that would protect access to natural gas to heat your home and power your business. Well, the Washington State Supreme Court is going to vote on that or is going to consider that case. The appeals court, King County Superior Court judge said that measure was too broad. It was passed by 52% of voters. They threw it out as being too broad. Now the Washington Supreme Court will take up the case. Back in a moment.
The Lars Larson Show.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you a story about public records, and I'll give you a little bit of background. I love public records because I think government ought to be about as transparent as your picture window in the front of your house. You ought to be able to see everything the government is doing and know what they're doing because, after all, you fund the government, and they only operate with the consent of the governed. And after all, if you consent to have government impose its will on your life, to be able to have the rules and regulations and all that, how in the world can you tell if the government is doing what it should be doing if you can't get to the public records that describe what they're doing? I know it's a little convoluted way to say it, but that's the thing that has bugged me for the longest time. I have used public records both at the local level and at the federal level under FOIA for literally decades to find out things about the government. And these days, there are lots and lots of organizations out there that will actually, openthebooks.com is one of them, that actually takes the government's data, which is usually presented to the public in such a way that you can read it and you have absolutely no idea what you're looking at. So it needs a little bit of interpretation, because if you simply said, show me the federal government's budget, they dropped something that looked like five New York City's phone books on your desk and say, go ahead, knock yourself out, because most of that information won't mean much to you. So I'm going to give you a specific example, but first I want to give you an invitation. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line. I may get to some naysayers here in a moment. The X poll today, should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers against violent attacks? I would answer that one yes. And make it voluntary. Don't tell any teacher they have to carry a gun. You will get plenty of volunteers. I can say that based on the phone calls and the emails I've had for decades. There are lots and lots of teachers out there who say they'd like to be able to carry a gun. They know how to carry a gun. They know how to use it safely, and they know how to use it to protect your kids. And if you say, well, they're not experts like cops, well, that's true. You know, teachers are also not firefighters. But have you ever been in a school that didn't have fire hoses and fire extinguishers in the hallways? You know, those teachers, they are not firefighters. But in an emergency, you want them to have the tools handy that will help them answer that kind of need. So the question is, should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers against violent attacks against those schools? But let me get back to this public health question. And that is a man by the name of Paul Terdahl. Paul Terdahl wanted to get information about transgender treatment on minors, what I call the surgical and chemical mutilation of teenage boys and girls. You know, where they're given hormones to try to transform them from male to female, female to male, and often surgery on top of that. Castration, double mastectomies. I mean, some real medical mangle is at work. So he went to the folks who have all the data, and in this case, the Oregon Health Authority, and he said the public law, the law says this is public information, all this aggregate data. This isn't the names and ages of children. It is, in fact, just data they collect on so-called transgender affirmation treatments on minors. Guess what? They have given him the information in the past. They have now said, we will not give you the information because we don't like the way that you plan to use the information. Now, some of you might say generically, well, they should be able to do that. No, they shouldn't. And in fact, the law says that the identity and the motive of the requester of public information is not relevant to the request. You could be asking to find out more about your neighbors. You could be asking because it's in your business. Maybe it's in your profession. You could be asking out of pure curiosity. Or you could be using it to try to arm the public to come out and say, here's the data. It doesn't work. You're hurting kids. We want you to stop. If that is your motivation, the agency involved, in this case, the OHA, is not allowed to say, because we don't like the way you plan to use the data, we're not going to let you have that data. Well, now it's going to court. And I reached out to Paul Turdahl. I don't know him, but apparently his attorney has said at this point it's not a good idea to go on the radio and start talking about that. But at some point, we will be able to talk to him about it. Of course, the state agency involved is also saying we don't want to talk about it because of pending litigation, which is a great excuse. What they should have to explain, and I hope that some state lawmakers go after them and say you should give this public data to the public as the law requires. And if you're not going to do it, you have to explain why. To your calls now. Let's go to Tim, who's a naysayer. Tim, I had mentioned earlier in the program that the governors of Oregon, Washington, and California now all say because they don't like the changes at the federal CDC, they're going to come up with their own state-level vaccine recommendations. And I don't think they're in a position to be able to do that. But you're a naysayer about that. Welcome to the program. Tell me what we disagree about today.
So, yes, sir. There nowhere in the Constitution does it line up that the feds are responsible for health stuff. Simply taking the money from states and sending it back to them, states are perfectly capable of having their own research institutions come up with their own requirements, et cetera, on that. If we took this approach with things like agriculture, education, and everything else, then we could shrink the government down. 75% of the money that comes to Oregon comes from the feds. Well, why are we giving them that tax money in the first place? They're just turning around and giving it back to us. So a real thing on it is this.
No,
is how
I'm with you
down.
On all of that, Tim, but let me ask you this. Do you think that a state-level agency, no matter which state it is, Oregon, Washington, California in this case, do they have the resources to be able to make recommendations to their citizens about whether or not to take one vaccine or another vaccine?
Absolutely. If they all work
Where did
together,
they get
especially
that?
When you're talking the West Coast. I mean, you've got some of the best research institutions in the country are in these three states.
Except, Tim, we're not talking about the research institutions. We're talking about politicians who say, we will tell you what we recommend you take. I don't see that
in the marketplace of ideas, if we were to take that approach, other states would choose otherwise, such as Florida saying, well, we think this is a bad idea and you shouldn't do it. And over time, things get fleshed out. In marketplace of ideas, you get the winners and losers.
I like the marketplace of ideas, and I like what Franklin called the laboratories of democracy, where one state can do it one way, a different state can do it a different way. But I'm just wondering whether or not they will. Because during the pandemic, we saw an awful lot of state health departments that fell flat on their faces, and they made recommendations that we later found out were completely flawed. Would you agree?
Yeah, but Lars, was Fauci, was the CDC
oh, Fauci was the
an
worst.
Honest broker?
No.
They weren't. And when they did what they did, it's a national level issue. At least if we took this approach with all things, it would break it down that states that have reasons to disagree can do what they do and reality comes out instead of a central authoritarian government that forces it down good decisions and bad.
You know what I'd like, Tim?
CDC's no less corrupt than everybody else.
You know
else.
Who I think ought to recommend which vaccines you take? Your doctor. And it should be your decision and your doctor. And I want the politicians to stay out of it. We should keep them out of it. Because otherwise you end up with Fauci's and you end up with other people like that. But, Tim, you're a very good naysayer, and I always appreciate a great naysayer. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Honestly provocative talk, but fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But first, In a moment, I've got to tell you, I'm really getting sick to death of all the cartel media stories, what I call the boo-hoo stories about the criminal illegal aliens whose deportation is being done on well-founded concrete reasons. They're getting kicked out of America for a good reason, and yet they get members of Congress and the media to go to bat for them and say, oh, isn't it sad? This poor man or this poor woman is being forced to leave the United States of America. I'm going to talk about one case in particular in just a moment, but first I want to get to a couple of your calls. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our X poll, here's the question. Should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers against violent attacks against that school? My answer is yes. The suggestion was made at a Tuesday afternoon press conference by President Donald Trump, who says we have great teachers who love our children. And he says, and if you took a small percentage of those teachers, maybe those with military background that were in the National Guard, etc., and you let them carry, they're trained, they know how to guard their classrooms. I always thought that would be an alternative. That's Donald Trump. I agree with him, and I've been saying it for a good long time. And I knew I'd get at least a few people coming back from the other point of view. Shane is a naysayer, and Shane, you know that we love naysayers on this program. Welcome, and what do you and I disagree about when it comes to arming teachers?
Well, I disagree that we need to arm teachers because if you think about the majority of teachers in the United States, they're all part of the teachers union. And the teachers union being against Trump and being against, judicial spending of our money, our taxpayer money, that's a conflict of interest. And for the majority of those people that are armed up, they have a negative view of this country overall as far as President Trump having a rule and authority and being being smart about
it. Yeah, but this really doesn't have to do with Trump. It has to do with whether or not you want to guard the kids in a school. And what their point of view is, I know a bunch of teachers, and I know a lot of teachers who have to be a member of the union, but they don't agree with the union, and they do agree with President Trump, and they are conservative. And every time we talk about this subject, I get teachers who send me emails or they call and they say, look, if I was given the ability to carry concealed, they'll tell me I've been carrying concealed for years. I'd like to do it at work, at the school. I could make sure that if anybody ever came into that building, the kids would be protected, except they can't. So your assumption that all the members of the teachers union or the vast majority of them are Trump-hating anti-gunners, I think, is flawed, and I don't think it's accurate. Now, would you say maybe 50% of them are? Fine. They aren't going to want to carry a gun either. So why not arm the teachers who would say to you, yeah, let me carry a gun, and if anything bad ever happens, I'll be capable of repelling force with force. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, I'm behind enemy lines here in Washington State, which is about as blue as you can get, thanks to mail-in voting. But you're also putting in conflict of interest where some states like Washington State have made it illegal to carry on school grounds, just period, as part of the state law. So myself being a red-blooded American, I would willingly live and die to protect those children. But you're also asking these teachers to go against the state law and make them
no all I would do is I think there's a way to do this, Shane, and here's the mechanism I'd use. And this is the kind of mechanism that's familiar to everybody. If you said, hey kids, to your kids, I'll pay for college, and one of your kids says, I'm going to go off and study underwater basket weaving and button sorting, you might say, I'm not paying for that. So the money controls. Be as long as you're writing the check, you should have something to say about it. If President Trump said schools that will actually allow teachers to carry will get the federal funds and those that don't will not. He's using the same mechanism on illegal aliens. If you want to be a sanctuary, go ahead and be a sanctuary for illegals, but then you're not going to get a bunch of federal money. So there's a way to push the states to do the right thing. And there are states like Missouri that already they explicitly legalized teachers carrying at school. And it works out very well. I've never heard of an adverse event happening in the state of Missouri because some of the teachers there carry guns, and they carry guns legally. So you'd have to deal with the state law, but the state legislature could then say, well, if we want the federal money, we've got to comply with the federal law and let the teachers carry. And in fact, there are already carve outs in most of the anti-gun states where they say there's a carve out for the military and there's a carve out for law enforcement, and they allow that. So past that, is there any reason not to allow teachers who volunteer to carry at work to do it?
I don't disagree that you can allow teachers to volunteer for it, but you're going to put their jobs into jeopardy if
you don't change the state law. I get it. No, but hold on. Well, why would I put their job at risk? With the teachers' union?
Well, the teachers' union can sit there and make Trump up some sort of a charge to get them fired or abscond with their job because they want to be a...
Okay, and maybe that's a realistic concern. But somehow in Missouri, they have teachers carrying, and there are several other states that allow teachers to carry, and the teachers' unions haven't done anything to them. So I appreciate the suggestion. Let's go to John, who's an ace here. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
I am in support of the wildfire hazard risk maps. I think it's really the first time to uncover a little dirty secret that the governor uses a Conflagration Act and spends millions of dollars sending highly trained firefighters from the Metroplex areas to areas that pay little or no fire insurance. So
little or no? Have you talked to anybody who lives in a rural area about the fire insurance they have to pay for?
Well, I mean, I've been on task force that gone to Prairie City, John Day, with highly trained union firefighters and multi-million dollar pieces of apparatus.
What does that have to do with what they're paying?
Because I think that much like the flood hazard maps, where if you own a piece of property in a flood zone, you should pay a higher premium because you chose to live in a flood zone.
I agree with you. And from what I know, John, the people who live in rural forested areas where fires are likely pay much higher rates than I do living in a city.
But the wildfire map does quantify some of those. So,
How does it quantify it, John? Because especially when you hear... The statistics that they used were wrong.
Well, let me quantify. I don't know anything about the Oregon wildfire maps, but I have built wildfire hazard maps in the state of Washington. And your earlier caller said, how can you have a subdivision with part of it green, part of it yellow? Well, it's based on slope, how steep the land is, aspect. Mm-hmm. Anything with a southern aspect has faster wildfire propagation.
And since the insurance companies use their own research and not the state's map, what good does it do for the state to have that map?
I think it's an educational tool, and that's how I used it.
Kind of an expensive one, isn't it?
As a retired fire chief. We used it as a educational tool for people to be able to prepare their area to be more.
And the only problem being that when they look at the map and realize it's thoroughly inadequate, it only educates them that the government can't do almost anything right. But, John, I appreciate the good naysayer. You got the Lars Larson
Show. The Lars Larson Show. What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I love the idea that America should be building more homes. And apparently the only folks who don't like that idea are the government. Because the government at both the federal level and the state levels have blocked home creation, the building of houses and apartment units and condos and everything else. And usually it's more at the local level than the federal level, although I think there are things that could be fixed at the federal level as well. So now Donald Trump is considering declaring a national housing emergency to try to go after this problem. And I thought we'd talk about it with Ty Lasseter, who's CEO of Lasseter Capital. Ty, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, it's great to be on here. Always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And I think I've divided it out appropriately. And if you think otherwise, please correct me. But most of the restrictions that get in the way of building houses are at the local level. I think Los Angeles is my favorite latest poster child example, where it costs something like 28% of the cost of a house in L.A. That's $1 million or $280,000 just to buy all the government permits to be able to put a shovel in the ground. And while it's not that severe in, say, other cities around America, that's a good example. If you want more housing, you got to get those things out of the way, don't you?
Yeah, it starts there, definitely. And you can use L.A. as a perfect example. I've got 750 investors across the country, and I've got a handful of them in L.A. that were affected by fires. And it's been however many months since those fires and since those clients of ours lost their homes, and they've yet to been able to even get across the desk to even start the process of getting proper documentation, proper approvals, proper permits and everything in L.A. It's just a nightmare. But on top of that, you mentioned federal, and federal has a huge impact on it. And hopefully after Jay Powell's most recent interview and speech at Jackson Hole is an indication of what the Fed is going to do. But I think midways into that speech, he self-realized that the two things that needed to be managed, inflation and jobs, have been managed, and the Trump tariffs are not having the negative effect on inflation that we thought they were. So those two things being in place should represent a downtick in interest rates, which would be a help from the Fed. But, I mean, let's face it, since COVID, you've got COVID, which impacted supply and demand for manufacturing. And then coming out of COVID, you've got interest rates hikes and inflation that was out of control. And so builders haven't built. And so now we're facing the problems that we as a country and our government haven't wanted to face. And that is the average home price is about $450,000, and median household income is $68,000 across the United States. And in order to afford the average home, you need to make $130,000. So we're at half that. So we've got to do something.
Well, and in fact, am I right to use, say, from a distance, I've watched San Antonio, and I think it's Austin, where they both said, this is crazy, let's cut a whole bunch of this red tape. And all of a sudden, they saw home construction take off like a rocket. And prices not only didn't rise like they did in the rest of the country, they actually declined. And so people were able to buy houses at a more reasonable price. With that kind of example, why isn't every city or every state, every county in America chasing that same kind of model?
Well, we can play politics all we want here, and not to take a side of the aisle, but I think you know which side I stand on. But those two cities fall within a conservative state. Those were two more liberal cities in a conservative state.
True.
And I think those two cities saw what was going on in Dallas-Fort Worth, and Dallas-Fort Worth was getting all of the relocation from the major Fortune 1000 companies, and they wanted to be able to compete. And so the only way to do so was to create incentives for businesses to relocate to those markets. And in order to do that, you've got to have affordable housing for the employees. And so I think they followed suit. And so I think there's going to be some other states that follow along there. But before we see that in our far west states that have the major concerns, I think we've got far greater problems that we've got to deal with there.
Well, Ty, I think I've thrown this idea at you before, but you're in the money business. I'm not. But tell me if this would work. I mean, Trump has talked about privatizing both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but while they are still sort of pseudo-government entities, would there be anything wrong with those entities saying, by the way, if you're a city or a county that's actually gone to more liberal, I hate to use that word, but because I'm like you, my politics are out there, my audience knows what they are. But if you said, we want you to cut a whole bunch of that red tape, and if you'll cut it down the way those cities have, and you can get more housing construction going on, you're going to get a lower interest rate. And the places that have the crazy rules, like L.A., you get to pay the higher rate, because the federal government uses mechanisms like that all the time to push what it wants, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a great idea. I would love to see that. There's definitely going to be people that that oppose that, people that are opposed to investors owning significant pieces of property across the United States. But let's face it, 10% of America has always owned 70% of the properties, and it's going to be that way. But the best way to make real estate affordable is to incentivize developers and investors to develop. And so I think the best thing that we can do is, knowing that the good Lord's not making more dirt, but we can create more dwellings on the dirt. At the end of the day, a single individual's personal home is not an investment. It can be argued that it's an asset, but still you have to put money into that and it doesn't pay you. So one of the best things that I've found to do is, when you've got equity in that property, take some equity out and invest in real estate, start developing. And the best way to incentivize people to do that would be for the agencies, Fannie, Freddie, and the like, to incentivize investors and developers to develop. And they did that with the individuals back prior to the 2008 subprime crisis. But when you do that with individuals, when individuals are buying their own personal home, but that home is not increasing their income, you're going to run into a problem when you're incentivizing individuals to buy a home that they can't afford. But when you're doing that for an investor, where the properties are going to generate income to pay for the debt, now you're looking at something that's going to, one, create more jobs, two, boost the economy, and three, it's going to manage what is going on in our housing crisis right now. It's going to create more affordable housing.
Well, can you imagine, Ty, that the number that I got stuck on was that this country is 4 million housing units short. Now, that's a mix of private, you know, single family homes, apartments, condos, and all that. Can you imagine if you could make the changes that in the next, say, 4 years would cause an additional 1 million housing units to be built in each of those years? How many more people would be employed as all the jobs that are involved in that? Concrete, lumber, carpenters, framers, you know, the people who do finish work on concrete and all the rest, roofers, the rest of that. That would generate a gigantic number of jobs, and they're jobs that are available to pretty much high school graduates who can go out and learn how to do, say, carpentry from the journeymen who do it well. And that the trades are begging for people right now. If you could do that, you generate all kinds of jobs, and those guys get paid good money.
Yeah, you labeled it. It's trades. Trades jobs are at a deficit right now, and we need those. And you make a great point. I mean, I only control about 5,000 housing units across the United States. That is a microcosm to the million that you mentioned, or the 4 million shortage we have. And at those 5,000, I employ across all of our trades and everything that goes on across the properties, probably 400 to 500 people at any given time. So you multiply that to up to a million, and that's 900,000 plus or minus jobs.
Put those people to work. That's Ty Lassiter, CEO of Lassiter Capital. Ty, thanks very much. It's a pleasure. Back in a moment, I'll get you your phone calls and emails. And on the Radio Northwest Network, Antifa rolls out a guillotine.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment brought to you by NickShivers.com. For an instant offer to sell your home immediately, no showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date, go to NickShivers.com for details. Consider this. Antifa has been waging, I guess you could call it a siege of the Portland ICE headquarters. This isn't the first time. The first time they laid siege to the ICE headquarters about 8 years ago. But now, as of last night, they rolled out a guillotine and then started a riot. And finally, and at long last, the police responded with munitions and tear gas. And yet, what does Portland Mayor Keith Wilson do? Again, he has a standing invitation to come back on the show. He had actually promised us on the air that he would come back to answer some hard questions. Lately, he doesn't seem to answer our emails or anything else. But I'd love to ask him, why is your first response after Antifa lays siege to the Portland ICE headquarters, burns a flag, and rolls out a guillotine? is to come out and reaffirm Portland's commitment to sanctuary policies. In other words, Keith Wilson cares more about standing up for people who are illegally in America and illegally in Portland than he does about looking out for the best interests of the actual citizens who live in the city where he is mayor, which means his tenure as mayor probably is only going to go till the next election. Although the number of crazy people on that Portland City Council, now that they've got 12 of them, oh, boy, my goodness, they are going crazy. And if you want to know what they have planned for you when it comes to housing, three of them are currently on a junket to Vienna, Austria, because they want to study socialized housing. And I had to actually look up the statistic just for context. Portland and Seattle have about 5 to 8% of people who live in subsidized government provided housing, either Section 8 or owned by the government. In Lisbon, it is 60%, 60% of the population lives in government-subsidized housing. And three members of the Portland City Council have now gone to Vienna to say, hey, this looks like the place to do it. Yeah, they've got two-thirds of their population living in subsidized government-run housing, and maybe we want to do that back at home. Does that sound crazy to you? Hear calls now. Let's start with Tony in Beaverton. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call. I'm an insurance agent for hard-to-insure risks in Oregon and Washington. And I want to dispel that the previous caller that you had, that he said that he's on tax rolls and he can see what the insurance is. I've got two clients last week, one of them in Redmond, one in Bend, that for a 1,000-square-foot home, brand-new built, insurance was over $6,000 a year.
Whoa. Holy cow.
It's not cheap. Yeah, and the thing is that even the standard insurances like Liberty Mutual, Allstate, you know, Chubb, Travelers, those are the primary markets. They won't take them anymore. And so they use fire maps. I had a client over in by Lake Washington, and it was a condo, and they got declined by Liberty Mutual because the fire map said that this was in the middle of a fire zone. Problem, across the street, there are $2 million homes that are being built. And we insured a couple of those about a month ago. So it all depends on the insurance carrier that decides to use which fire map and which out-of-date fire map to use to fit their underwriting rules. Now,
and, secondary Tony, market, by the way, I want to throw in because I want your comment on this. The guy we had on earlier today, and we've put the interview up on our website, he's a statistician by training, and he says the way they did the numbers for those maps, where they said we're going to show the top 10%, the 10th percentile is going to show as high hazard, and the other 90% will not. We're not. But he said when he dug into the numbers, they were actually using a number closer to 58, meaning 40% of the map was listed as high hazard, and 60% was not. And that's a gigantic difference if it comes to rates like you just quoted. You know, what do we do when any state, in this case, state of Oregon, but it could just as easily be the state of Washington, says we're going to designate you as being in a high hazard area and you're going to be paying through the nose for insurance?
Well, here's the thing, Lars, though. The express markets, which is often the market that is same exact insurance, it's just carriers that are not what's called standard rates like Liberty Mutual and Allstate or Geico. They will not use those fire maps. I've got those clients I was telling you about, the $5,000 and $6,000 insurance. I was able to get it for half the cost with what's called secondary markets. So they don't look at those fire maps because the carriers don't care. They're saying, hey, you're paying your insurance premiums. We calculate that into our risk. And, of course, if one carrier comes back and puts a moratorium, like I've got a client that has a house in North Carolina, we cannot insure in certain counties right now because there is a moratorium. However, so they all jump on that bandwagon. Otherwise, certain carriers will use the fire maps, and a lot of carriers don't. So my suggestion to your listeners is that if you can't find your standard, what you hear on the radio from a insurance carrier perspective, call around some insurance agents and say, hey, I want to go into secondary markets. And then they will be able to get you, or excess markets.
And the insurance is just as good, right? Because the insurance company will say, we will agree to insure this much property and this much value for this many dollars. And they'll tell you what it's going to be, right?
Yep, exactly. So liability the same, property coverage the same. Now, the deductibles might be a little bit different, you know, $2,500 versus $5,000. But if you can reduce your premium from $6,000 to $3,000, why not do it?
Yeah, if you save $3,000 the first year, paying a little bit bigger deductible is not that big a deal. Tony, thanks very much. It's Wednesday, it's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to talk about Tina Kotek's tax plans and the special session that, along with the regular session, has turned into a Tina Kotek-sponsored train wreck. Can Republicans insist that state governments simply pay attention to the wishes and the testimony of citizens, that state agencies be held accountable, and I mean really accountable, people have to get fired, and that those agencies have to live within their means and not just turn to the voters constantly and say, give us more of your money or else. Representative Ed Deal joins me now, who represents Oregon's District 17. Representative Deal, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, great to be with you.
The reason I call it a train wreck, you had one run at $15 billion during the regular session, then a slightly smaller amount, and both of those crashed and burned, didn't seem to have much leadership from Kotek. And then she calls a special session deliberately on a holiday weekend, and then her proposal gets barely voted through on the House side with the help of one Republican House member, and now we're putting off the Senate vote for 2 weeks because they've got a Democrat out sick. I mean, I wish for Mr. Gorsuch's full recovery, but they're going to put it off for 2 weeks as though it's not really an emergency. She's walked you right up to the edge of the cliff and then says, yeah, but we'll wait 2 weeks because we can't afford to be without one member of the Senate there. That all seems very strange to begin with, so I'll let you start wherever you want to start on that mess.
Yeah, well, it's kind of ironic that on Labor Day, the day we celebrate workers, our governor calls an emergency session to tax the very workers we're supposedly celebrating. So let's start with that. And we've had overwhelming opposition to this bill. The thing is, with the Senate, the governor needs every Democrat there, all 18 of them, to pass this because there's not a single vote on the Senate side from the Republicans to support this. So this is kind of it's new territory for us to stretch an emergency session out this long. But if she wants this, she really has no other choice. The thing is, I don't know if this can really happen on the 17th or not. I don't know the details of Senator Gorsuch. I hope he gets healthy and has a strong recovery. But
so do I.
Yeah.
But if he's gone, what's the usual process? I mean, I still remember when Obamacare got voted through because that idiot John McCain, and he was an idiot, had to fly all the way back, and oh, he's such a hero, and then goes back and sells out the whole Republican Party by voting the wrong way. How much latitude does Kotek have to say, well, we'll just wait till all the Democrats are there because I'm not going to have a vote before then? Does she have that much latitude?
Well, we are looking into this. I believe that every 3 days we have to gavel in and gavel out to hold up to our constitutional obligation. But I think this could continue to be drug out as long as we do that.
Well, I've got an idea for you. Do they have to have a quorum to gavel in, Ed?
No, they don't.
Oh, okay.
They can. They just need someone to show up to gavel in. They gavel out every 3 days. They're meeting their obligation.
Okay.
And theoretically, I think this could stretch out for a long time, but that's not obviously not desirable for anybody.
I want to ask you. The Republicans have offered a counterplan, saying you can do it within the money that's already there, no raise in taxes. And the Democrats will not allow a vote on that. Am I right?
No. They will not allow a vote on that. They really didn't even want to talk to us about it. They just dismissed it as impractical. But the thing is, and I talked a lot about this in my floor speech in opposition to this bill, this is about priorities. And you ask any Oregonian out there, they do not want to pay more taxes. They're being pinched, and they do not trust ODOT to spend their tax dollars wisely, and they want to see a plan that reprioritizes ODOT spending without more taxes. And the thing is, it can be done. And unfortunately, the governor didn't want to do that. And instead, she gave us this false choice. If you don't pass this thing, we're going to lay off transport. We're going to lay off maintenance workers.
Blue collar.
And
no white collar gets the axe, right?
No. Well, there are some that are on the layoff list, but the hardest hit is maintenance. And she knows that's where people will feel the most pain. And I know it's the oldest trick in the book on the political playbook, but she's playing politics. She's holding maintenance workers and taxpayers hostage to get this higher tax passed. And I think it's just wrong.
Okay, let me ask you about a possible fix. Has the legislature committed money to the Rose Quarter project that is, for all intents and purposes, dead right now?
Yes.
How much? About how much?
I'm not sure how much that is on the Rose Quarter project. I think it's around $200 million.
There's $200 million of the five... They would get from this increase, right?
Yes, and they were asking for considerably more money beyond even the $500 million that the feds were going to give them. So I think all told, we were planning on about a $600 million commitment from the state for that project. But yes, and we're breaking ground on it, even though the feds have backed off.
Well, I know they had the big ceremony, Monday or last week?
And
said, hey, we're celebrating breaking ground on a project. We have no idea how we're going to pay for it. If they pulled that $200 million back, that's almost half of what ODOT needs right now. How about IBR? Is IBR, because I've made the case that IBR is, the bridge is dead. They don't have the federal money. They don't, Greg Johnson won't tell you how much it's going to cost. My guess, $10 billion. Which is going to be a shocking number, and they've got less than half the money to build the $7 billion bridge. That puts them seriously short on $10 billion. If that project is dead, how much does ODOT have committed to that?
Yeah, well, great question. So we committed, the legislature committed, $1 billion, allocating for a bond, and it was $250 million every budget cycle. I think the governor just signed for the next $250 million. So there's half a million that's already been committed. But we could take legislative action and claw back the remaining half a million.
Yeah, the bonded debt, you have to explain to the bondholders. But at the end of the day, Ed, the bonds have to be paid back no matter what you spend the money on, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. So the bondholders should be happy because they know they can go to the state of Oregon and say, hey, you borrowed the money, pay it back, and the state will. So take that money, make ODOT whole for now, basically say live within your means, and stop all these crazy projects. Ed, I'm going to want to talk to you more between now and whenever they vote on this, because like you, I'm not sure they'll be back 2 weeks from now. Maybe Senator Gorsuch will be back. Maybe you and the Republicans are going to have to walk out and just deny them quorum and say, live within your means, that's what you get. And if you punish the citizens, then the citizens need to punish Tina Kotek. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. That's Representative Ed Diaz.
The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I get sick and tired of the cartel media and all their boo-hoo stories about criminal illegal aliens whose deportation is well-founded in the law, and yet they literally get the media, the cartel media, that is, not us, and members of the U.S. Congress and everybody else to go to bat for them. The latest example is a character by the name of Jose Bertin Cruz Estrada. Now, why is he a celebrated case? I will tell you the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the program and welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism. If you want to join that conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can answer our X poll. You'll find the X poll question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Now, about Jose Bertin Cruz Estrada, I'm sure I'm not rolling enough R's in there, but this is a really bad guy. And let me tell you why I say he's a bad guy. Go all the way back to 2003. He had come into the United States. He was born in Mexico. He is a Mexican national. 10 years later, he got to stay for 10 years, and then he was arrested and charged with racketeering, delivery of methamphetamine, and conspiracy to commit a felony. Guess what happened after he was convicted? He was deported to Mexico and then almost immediately tried to come back into the United States illegally again. Now, there's one thing you should know about immigration law. I'm not a lawyer, but I know this detail. The first time you come in illegally, they consider it a federal civil offense, meaning you're going to pay a fine and you're probably going to get booted out of the country. The second time, after you've been deported once, if you re-enter the United States, it is considered a felony, a federal felony. So he tries to come back into Texas from Mexico. He gets caught in Texas. He is detained for 7 months, and once again, he is deported. Well, that was about 2013 or 2014, about a decade ago. Then he managed to get back into the United States. If he came in 2019, he came back into the United States and he started a business and he raised his son. He worked jobs and all the rest of this. And then he got arrested the other day. And there are all these folks, including his family, his brother and others, who say, oh, this is terrible. Even his brother Oscar says, I'm not going to sit here and defend and say my brother was perfect. He wasn't. He got in trouble. He paid his dues. He had a sentence. I feel like he has suffered from two different jails, being locked up and being essentially locked out from his family, because just last month he was picked up once again and they're probably going to deport him again the third time. And why? Because he's illegally in the country. Let me remind you of one thing. And again, this is one of those other details that you know about immigration law. If somebody has a green card, I used to have a producer for this program, a young lady who was a Canadian, and she had a green card to work in the United States. She'd been in the United States for decades. And she knew, because she'd mentioned it to me from time to time. She'd say, if I ever commit a crime, I'm going to lose my green card and get kicked out. So we apply that same rule to people who've come in legally. If you came in illegally and then you commit a serious crime, like delivery of methamphetamine and conspiracy to commit a felony, you definitely should get booted out. And if you've been previously deported, not once, not twice, but three times like this guy, well, they picked him up because a firefighting crew, not a city firefighting crew, but a wildland or forest firefighting crew, had hired him from a private contracting company. He was supposed to cut up logs that were being taken down as they fought these fires and section the logs up so they could be hauled away. Well, ICE showed up. And boy, I'll tell you, members of Congress have come to his defense and said, this is outrageous that you have arrested Jose Estrada. Well, why is it outrageous? He was in the country illegally once, got deported in the country a second time, committed a major crime, got deported, came back in again, and now he's been picked up to be deported once again. What's wrong with that? And yet the mainstream media will always portray this in a very sensitive way. Brother of firefighter arrested by Border Patrol while fighting wildfire speaks out. He paid his dues. No, he didn't. He went into the drug trade. He got convicted of a federal felony. He was then deported a couple of times. He hasn't paid his dues. He did not come into my country legally. He came in illegally time and time and time again. And I ask you this. When people try to immigrate to the United States legally, they present themselves at a U.S. embassy or a consulate. They fill out the paperwork. They look into your background. They say, we want to make sure that you don't become a welfare case. They call it a public charge, but it's the same thing. And we don't want people coming into the country who are not going to follow the law. In fact, if we give you a green card and you go out and break the law, we're going to take your green card away and send you home. This guy hasn't paid anything like his dues. He has showed incredible disdain for the laws of the United States. Now, the rest of us are held to those laws. And what will always throw me is that when Democrat members of Congress stand up and they advocate for a man not to be deported, even though he's never done it legally, he's come into our country illegally, he's been deported time and again, and you, a member of Congress, are going to stand up and say, you should let him stay. It's not fair to send him home. It is more than fair to send him home. And the fact that the mainstream cartel media does this, they tell all these boo-hoo stories. I wish if I were a TV news director, I never was, but I worked for a lot of TV news directors. If I were a TV news director, I'd say every time we do one of these boo-hoo stories, I want you to go out and find me somebody, find a person whose family member was murdered by an illegal alien. And there are plenty of victims of that. Find me someone whose family member was raped by an illegal alien. Find me somebody whose member of their family was died from drugs brought into the country by an illegal alien. Do at least one story for every single one of those stories that is done on the boo-hoo side of things. Here calls. Let me start with John, who's an ace here. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about?
Well, Jose probably had an excellent voting record. Anyway, my call was regarding, vaccines. I'm not going to put any vaccine in my arm until they take the liability waiver off it. If they're so worried about getting sued, then it's got to be dangerous.
Okay, that's an interesting point. No disagreement there. Let's go to Gordon, who's a naysayer. Gordon, what do you and I disagree about makes you a naysayer?
I'm really skeptical about all this gun talk in the school because I think the learning environment is, like, pampered. And if they want to have PE teaching, I can't imagine growing up with knowing there's a gun on my, PE teacher's belt.
Or even why not?
Studying algebra.
Why not, Gordon?
Like
why would that be disturbing?
Because it's distracting.
It's distracting to know that there are things there. Is it distracting to know that out in the hallway in every school there's fire extinguishers and fire hoses? Is that distracting?
No. But
and yet they're there for the very unlikely event that the school would catch fire and somebody might have to fight it till the fire department shows up. And yet you're not distracted by that, but you would be distracted by a teacher capable of protecting his or her students? Crazy.
The Lars Larson Show. Are you experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. There are states, especially those on the west coast of the United States, that are saying we don't like what's being done at the CDC under a new presidential administration, so we're going to develop our own vaccine policies. I thought that sounded problematic to me, so I thought I'd test it with Dr. David Gortler, who's a former Yale University School of Medicine professor of pharmacology and former medical officer at the FDA, senior advisor to the FDA Commissioner of Drug Safety. Dr. Gortler, welcome to the program.
Oh, Lars, I'm a fan. It's an honor to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. So tell me this. Is this a good idea to have states come up with their own independent vaccine policies? Because I think you can tell I'm skeptical.
Well, and rightly so. So I don't think this is a good idea. On one coast, we've got elites telling us, you know, Washington and Oregon and California saying, you know, they want to be the one who does the work of the FDA and the CDC. And then on the other coast, Florida, they also are saying we don't trust what the FDA and the CDC are doing. We also want to make our decisions for completely different reasons, by the way. One of them wants to eliminate mandates. And the other one wants to, I'm guessing, enact mandates based on their data.
And that's my guess as well. And in fact, Dr. Gortler, doesn't it make more sense that if I want to make my decision, I can make my decision in consultation with my own personal doctor, can't I?
Well, freedom to choose medicine, absolutely. I mean, who
wants to? Oh, I'm sorry, that phrase,
right?
Is only allowed to be used by Democrats in regards to killing babies, doctor. I don't know if they covered that at Yale University School of Medicine, but... I hate to interrupt you.
Brilliant.
Well, I did. But I mean, why they, and I have this suspicion, although most of the cartel media don't tell it this way. Am I right in suspecting that the reason they want the mandates is they want to make sure that the vaccine companies sell lots and lots of vaccine? And if they put it in as a recommendation or a mandate or whatever, then they will. And if they just leave people to their own devices, the vaccine companies may not make as much or sell as much vaccine. Am I on the wrong path on that?
No, you're absolutely right. When vaccines become mandated by federal agencies, Big Pharma automatically makes billions, and pharmacists are allowed to inject them wantonly. And unfortunately, the problem is they're doing it against findings, epidemiological findings, showing us that, you know, number one, you know, kids, children, adolescents do not need those COVID vaccines. They just don't need them. The epidemiology has showed us, dating back to the International Journal of Infectious Disease, a 2021 article that showed all variants of COVID from Omicron going forward don't kill anybody. Nobody's dying from COVID anymore.
And in fact, do the vaccine, let me ask you a really pedestrian question, Dr. Gortler, but I know you've got a credential, a CV that's really impressive, but do they work?
Does what work?
Do the vaccines work? Because you go back to 21 when Joe Biden said, if you get the vaccine, you can't catch COVID at all. And you thought, okay, we know that's not true because there are lots of multiple times vaccinated people who've caught COVID multiple times. Do they actually do what the FDA says they're supposed to do?
So they will not prevent infection and will not prevent transmission. What they do is they'll protect you from deadly versions of COVID. But those deadly versions of COVID, the initial strains that came out, like the Alpha, that's way far behind in our rearview mirror. You know, that's like late 2020, early 2021, late 2019 kind of talk. And so when something mutates, you know, because we live in a universe that favors chaos, right?
Yep.
So when and this is something I taught my students, you know, what can go wrong will go wrong in the lab. And so something that was that especially made people sick for you know, with its initial variations, as you know, it replicates itself, there are errors, and those errors make it less virulent. Not necessarily less contagious, but less virulent. So no, it will not prevent transmission, and it will not prevent spreading. People will still get it, but they won't get a deadly version, which is extinct anyway.
And it really is literally extinct at this point. Is there any sign of those original strains that they're picking up? You know, when they do all these, they sound like fun studies to do, sampling city sewage streams and see whether or not it's there. Is it there anymore?
Nobody is dying of COVID anymore. Some people are dying with COVID because they have comorbid conditions. And, you know, perhaps, maybe, and I'm not saying this for sure, but maybe it could be out there. It could still be there if these mRNA shots were innocuous, if they weren't dangerous at all. But, I mean, if you look at the latest VAERS reports, in the United States alone, there's well over a million adverse event reports. You know, 20,000 deaths. 20,000 additional people permanently disabled, 40,000 people with allergic reactions, not to mention people, about 16,000 people who had life-threatening adverse reactions to this drug had they not been taken to a hospital immediately. And so these drugs are not—they're still unsafe, and they don't protect against—they don't protect against the latest strains. The strains we're on now are, I think they're talking a few months ago was the Nimbus strain, the NB1.8.1, and now there's the Stratus strain, which they also, it's also known as the XFG, which I'm not even sure it stands for. But the bottom line is people don't need it, especially children, kids, adolescents don't need it. And on top of that, even if somebody did catch something that was not one of the deadly strains, there's alternative treatments for it, and I've written about this extensively. Hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, budesonide, colchicine, vitamin D, tons of alternatives that are very inexpensive.
Well, in fact, Doc, I was following vitamin D early on in the pandemic, and there was a doctor out of, I think, Scotland, Campbell, who was really interesting to follow because he even explained the mechanism by which D, you know, in healthy individuals who had a sufficient level of D, many of us who live in northern latitudes don't get a lot of sun, so we don't have a lot of D, and they said very few people at all died who had sufficient levels of vitamin D, and that's cheap and available.
That's right. You know, what constitutes hard work today is sitting inside in front of a computer. We're no longer outside, you know, tilling the soil. But vitamin D is something available generically from many manufacturers, very inexpensive. I'm not marketing any of these drugs. I don't hold any stocks in any of this. I'm just saying there's other ways to either prevent yourself from catching COVID or treating it when it happens. And mRNA, if mRNA was the only answer, perhaps, but it's not. It's not. There are tons of alternative treatments.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Gortler. I'm talking to Dr. David Gortler, former Yale University School of Medicine professor of pharmacology. He's also worked for the FDA. So if they do this and they say, we will coordinate vaccine recommendations, are these state governments going to do anything like what would ordinarily be done, say, at your old agency, the FDA, and actually study this? Or are they just going to sit down and say, you should take all the shots? Because I'm hard-pressed to imagine state-level governments doing any kind of serious investigation or, you know, coordination of these vaccine recommendations.
Well, you know, maybe we should talk about, you know, one of the things you mentioned is should they sit down there and take all of these shots? Well, if right now there's about 100 different vaccines in various stages of development that they want to give children starting at birth. And it includes, you know, they're already giving Hep B at birth to children who are, wow, and infants, excuse me, which are not at risk. There's also like HPV, which they give out there, AIDS and herpes. Now, there's something in common with these vaccines is that they're all, these diseases, excuse me, they're all 100% preventable, right? And I mean, yep, unless somebody knows when a child is born that they're going to be, you know, a prostitute or an intravenous drug abuser, they don't need to be giving shots to these children.
Dr. David Gortler, who is former Yale University School of Medicine, professor of pharmacology, former medical officer at the FDA. Dr. Gortler, thank you so much. I look forward to our next conversation. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Don't forget that every Friday we celebrate First Amendment Friday on this show. We open up the phone lines and every subject is fair game. This segment of the program is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our ex-poll today question, the question today is, should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers against violent attacks? My answer to that is yes. And Donald Trump made the suggestion at a press conference on Tuesday. He said, we've got great teachers that love our children. And he says, if you took a small percentage of those teachers and armed them, they'd be trained. He says, I think that's a better alternative than leaving those schools unprotected. And I think he's absolutely right. Should American public schools arm a small percentage of teachers And I would not assign that duty to teachers. I would allow the teachers who want to volunteer for that duty to do it. And there'd be some strict requirements that you've got to mind your P's and Q's if you're carrying a gun. It's brought to you today by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to Kevin. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just where we disagree on something is where I'm going to say I'm half joking, but I'm half serious.
Okay.
I think these vaccine mandates are one of the best things that's happened to America, but for the opposite reason than anyone thinks it is.
And what's that?
The excess deaths among all the industrialized countries that took the vaccines are still at a 10% excess rate. And turbo cancers among everybody, including young people, are off the charts.
Yeah, they are.
I was going to say between Democrats not reproducing at the rate of Republicans, and between them taking all these vaccines, and then with us getting all the voter rolls cleaned up, I think Republicans should be doing pretty good in about 10 years if we're all still around.
I mean, it's kind of dark humor, but I get the point you're making, that the Democrats are doing themselves in. They're not reproducing at replacement rate. In fact, they're far below replacement rate. And they're taking all the jabs the government tells them to take. And you're saying just let nature take its course.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, at a certain point, you know, you just got to let, as unchristian as this sounds, you just got to let God take the wheel and let people do themselves in. If they're that dumb and they want to fit in that much and they want to be part of the in crowd, everybody taking their vaccines, everybody being gay and not having kids and, you know, the dinks or sinks, the double income, no kids, go ahead and do it. Spend all your money on fancy juices and wine.
I guess the only part that really bothers me about, well, not the only part, but one of the parts that bothers me is when the government is pushing this stuff. If people go out on their own and they want to pursue something, and you and I would look at it and go, that's not a smart thing to do with your life, but it's your life. You're over 21. You can read, write, and count. And as long as you're paying your own bills, do whatever stupid thing you want to do. But in this case, government is pushing it. And that part of it honestly makes me very uncomfortable because it means that government is telling people to do things that are absolutely foolish. And if you don't believe me, take a look at Brandon Johnson in Chicago. 2 years ago, the mayor of Chicago was saying, I live in a high crime city and I live in a high crime neighborhood. Today, if you talk to Brandon Johnson, he'll tell you, oh no, there's no crime emergency in Chicago. The fact that 60 people got shot last weekend alone and 9 people died. No. There's no crime problem here. Move along. Let's go to Al. Hey, Al, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, I got questions about the illegals getting their licenses in Oregon.
Driver's licenses? That's a whole story. But go ahead. What was your question?
The contractor's license. Like if you go in to get a contractor's license, you have to have a social security number because you got to get a bond. And here in Oregon and maybe Washington, they're handing out contractor's licenses to illegal aliens without having any kind of social security card.
That's a good question because you know what I suspect they're doing, Al? I mean, without checking, I'll see if I can find out, although a lot of the state bureaucracies are not very cooperative in telling you the information,
yeah,
even though it's public info. When it comes to banking, they use their ITIN number, and that's a fraud as well, and that it ought to be outed. But I'm not sure what they do when they go in and say, okay, you can be a contractor, you have to get a bond, the bond's going to take your Social Security number to get one. I don't know if they're using a fake. And the bonding company, is it the state that demands the Social Security or is it the bonding company that demands it? Do you know?
I'm sure it's the bonding company because they got to go after somebody if you screw up.
And maybe the bonding companies are just rolling the dice saying, okay, we know you've got a crazy fake Social Security number, but as long as you pay your premiums, we don't care. And they may actually be taking that attitude. I mean, you know that if you're in the banking business right now and somebody walks in with an ITIN, you know to a near certainty that person is illegally in the United States. Everybody with a green card has a social. Everybody who's a citizen has a social who wants one. And so when the bank sees all these people, thousands or tens of thousands with I-10, the individual taxpayer ID numbers, Al, you can't have one legally, and I can't have one either because I'm a citizen. And so you say, well, doesn't the bank then know that they're doing business with an illegal alien? And as far as I can tell, the banks really don't give a damn. All they care is you're depositing money in our bank, and that's what we care about the most, which is kind of a sad commentary on bankers, but there you go. Al, thanks so much for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson